Hey, good morning, church.
Good morning.
Cusp of a new year. As we open today in the book of 2 Chronicles, I'm going to just do a little review. Many of you may remember that we started a series on the king some time back, walking through the life of David and Solomon, last couple of years now. And then made the turn to Rehoboam, and we're going to spend the next little while walking through the period of the kings. And I love this section where we get to go back and look at Old Testament stuff. We try not to burden you with it, but we do think it's important for Christians to understand their Old Testament, to gain a certain expertise in it. And along with that come a handful of dates that we want to remember. Namely, we date the Exodus around 1445 B.C., and so we date the period of the Judges between the late 13s up until around the time of 1100 B.C., and then we go into a period of the kings, King Saul first, followed by David, David coming around 1000 B.C., probably dated more to about 1010 B.C., ending his reign in 970, Solomon picking up in 970 and reigning roughly to 930. And so today, we pick up around 930 B.C., right? And you don't have to know all of those dates, but if you could just sort of tack in there, 1445 Exodus, King David around 1000 B.C., they date it to 1000 B.C., but it's probably a little earlier than that. They like those nice round numbers. And then, of course, that we have these two dates that affect the kings, the period of the kings, specifically 722 B.C. That is the period when the northern ten tribes disappear, never to be seen again. And that is the Assyrian captivity, followed by the date of Nebuchadnezzar's conquering of the southern kingdom of Judah in 586 B.C. And, of course, that transitions us over, and we walk down to Alexander the Great and walk into the period of the Maccabees and then the Roman takeover and all of those kinds of things. And, you know, coming at it from a historical perspective, many of you know my master's degree is in Old Testament. I gain a tremendous amount of insight from those dates and specifically holding all of those historical details in my head. I love sort of the interplay of all that. Some of you may not, and I get that. Some of you hate history. As a result, you're doomed to repeat it. But that's fine. That's a choice that you want to make. I am not going to stand here. It's just terrible. All right. But, so today we're around 930 B.C. Now, remember, we're coming off the lessons of David. In David's early part of his ascendancy to the throne, that we see David fighting Goliath, David dealing with the Philistines, David on the run from Saul. And those are formidable sort of obstacles that he faced. However, we find that David's greatest trials come after he is king, because it's in David's kingdom, in his kinghood, in his kingship, that we see his sin with Bathsheba, the murdering of Uriah the Hittite. We see David numbering the people and falling into laziness and indolence as a king and not paying attention as he ought, not seeking the Lord as he should, and finding himself under trial from the Lord, judgment, right? In David's early part of his ascendancy and his early reign, David's fighting the right battles and identifying a walk with the Lord as the thing that's keeping him grounded. In his later years, he suffers and struggles with how to apply that in real life. And so we learn a lesson from that, don't we? That beginning well is no guarantee of finishing well. And Christian, take that to heart, that just because you have begun well, just because you have gotten your feet up under you, just because you're walking with the Lord today, that's no promise or guarantee that you can now coast. It doesn't work that way. And so then, of course, Solomon comes in. And Solomon, when he begins his reign, is such an earnest and godly young man. As he is in an interview with God, and God says, "Hey, what would you want more than anything?" And Solomon says, "Wisdom." And what's the purpose of wisdom? "So that I will know how to rule this people well." And God grants him that. And then it's in his later adulthood, we see Solomon, in fact, exchanging wisdom for foolishness and becoming profligate. He gets addicted to money and women and the glory of it all. And so we learn that lesson. The three greatest trials that you can face in your life, so to speak, are gold, glory, and girls, or sort of your version of that. Right? And so Solomon begins well and finishes poorly. And the example he leaves for his children presents a number of challenges for them. And so what we see is that immediately following Solomon's reign, Rehoboam comes to the throne. And this brings us to 2 Chronicles chapter 10. And I will just summarize for you today. Rehoboam comes in and he is sitting there with a decision in front of him. During the later years of Solomon's reign, Solomon had over exceeded where he could go with his kingdom. That in essence, the scriptures say that during the days of Solomon, silver had lost its value because it was so common. Wealth was everywhere. The days were filled with all of the good things of life. And this was a period in which God's people flourished, but also a period in which God's people took a great deal for granted. Now remember, let's pause. And one of the reasons we remember the Exodus at 1445 BC is because this is a period in which God introduces himself to his people and teaches them who he is. They had had from Israel, from Jacob, they had had the tradition of Yahweh worship. They had had the tradition of their God, but they had been in Egypt for 400 years, exposed to the idolatry and gods of Egypt. And so for them, transitioning from the gods of Egypt to Yahweh was a very difficult decision. And we learned a lesson there too, is that under stress, you go back to the gods you know, right? And so Israel would do fine in serving the Lord and following the Lord until they hit a rough patch, until they hit a point of stress. And sometimes those stresses were very little, sometimes they were very big, but they would go back to those old gods. And getting the old gods out of Israel proved harder than propositionally. But by the time of David, there was a well-established core of the nation that sought the Lord. And so that was the tradition. And during the days of Solomon, with the erection of the temple there in Jerusalem, and we had talked about it, and we talked about it ad nauseum, that the temple in Jerusalem cost the equivalent of $5 billion. And there was the centrality of worship on God in this glory day. But remember, the days of David and Solomon were 80 years together, less than a century. Less than a century of devoted, focused national worship on God. And as soon as Solomon died, things began to fall apart. And we pick up in 2 Chronicles chapter 10. Rehoboam comes to the throne, and he is sitting there with a decision. Economically, I have taxed the people. I have put them through a great deal under my father David, my father Solomon. Now, what do I do as I come to the throne? And the question is, there's going to be a sense of David and Solomon and strength, but now the new kid is on the block. Remember, Rehoboam had not been raised on warfare, nor had he charted his own course economically, diplomatically, the way that Solomon had. He is the king who will be tested. What will he do? And so he is advised by two groups of people. One are the old guard under his father who says, "Rehoboam, it is time to step back, retool the nation, lower taxes, free people up, stop with all of the public works projects, and let's just consolidate our position in the world. And then there's the young guys, the young toughs, who come along beside Rehoboam and they say, no, no, no. Rehoboam, you prove to the nation that you're even bigger and better than your dad. Now, I got to tell you, if Solomon's your dad, that's a pretty gutsy thing to say. I'm bigger and better than he is. Solomon is the guy who makes Israel a world power, not just a regional power, but an international powerhouse. He makes Israel an international corporation. And you don't build on that. And say, Rehoboam says, you know my father's loins? Well, that's my pinky. I'm bigger and better. I can do more. And everybody says, no way, Jose. And Israel divides. And so the northern 10 tribes follow a man named Jeroboam. And you guys remember Jeroboam? Jeroboam had been in charge of Solomon's public works projects. He had read the signs and knew that stress was coming in the kingdom. And he was beginning to set himself up as a potential ruler of the northern 10 tribes. Solomon found out about it, was unsuccessful in killing him. And so he ran down to Egypt to stay with a guy named Shishak the First. And Shishak the First was the institutor, the pharaoh of the 22nd dynasty in Egypt. And so he is beginning a new thing, and he's the guy on the rise. And Jeroboam finds a home with him. And as soon as Rehoboam challenges the people and the people split, Jeroboam is back in the northern 10 tribes and becomes the king of that place. And we pick up there at the end of 2 Chronicles chapter 10, moving into 2 Chronicles 11. And so now Israel and Judah are two different places. Previously, Israel and Judah had been an armed camp in protection and in solidarity against the world around them. Now, Israel and Judah are two armed camps who have their guns pointed outside of their country, but also pointed at each other. And Rehoboam, discontent, disheartened, stuck with only Benjamin and Judah as his inheritance, he says, maybe we should reassert control over the northern 10 tribes, but God's prophet comes and says, you will not fight your relatives. This is your fault, and you're going to have to live with the consequences. And so Israel and Judah set up an uneasy peace between them. And this is a demarcation point. This is a point where both groups of people are on a decline. This is the state of the kingdom. A mere 80 years after David consolidated Israel into one small nation that grew into an international powerhouse, inside 80 years, and all of a sudden, in a couple of years, it's all gone. However, Rehoboam still has the money. He still has the money. Solomon had created an environment of economic prosperity in which silver became valueless, gold was so prosperous, and we see that Rehoboam is firmly ensconced in a very obedient and a very loyal Benjamin and Judah, and he's sitting on piles of money, not the end of the world, not a bad position, but the world has changed. The world changed now in that Israel is not the center of the world. All of those kings who paid homage, who Israel exercised hegemony over, all of those kings no longer make the trip to Jerusalem to sit at the feet of the king. Rehoboam is certainly no Solomon. And so we pick up in 2 Chronicles chapter 12, verse 1. When the kingdom of Rehoboam was established and strong, he and all Israel with him forsook the law of the Lord. And it came about in Rehoboam's fifth year, because they had been unfaithful to the Lord, that Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. Now this we need to understand. This is the point where everything starts to flesh out. This is the state of the kingdom. Now remember, we've learned some lessons, right? We've learned some lessons from David's reign. You guys remember Joab. Joab was David's right-hand man. He was his bulldog. And I said, you know, many of you may have a Joab in your life. And you got to be careful when you have a Joab in your life, because a Joab will do what he's so loyal to you. He will do wrong things to serve you and make your life better. I think some of the youth group had sort of, you know, sat down and said, hey, who can be my Joab? Right? Sort of consolidating power within their particular cliques, right? And so there, you have to watch out for a Joab. And so when David was dying, he said to Solomon, he said, hey, Solomon, here's the deal. Joab's my Joab. He's not going to be your Joab, so here's the deal. When I die, you're going to have to kill Joab. And so that also may be the case in your own life. You may have to at some point realize, oh, I'm going to kill this Joab, or he's going to be a problem. Right? Because we learned a lesson. Whatever isn't dealt with immediately becomes a problem. Right? And so Jeroboam isn't dealt with immediately. He becomes a problem for Solomon, and he becomes a problem for Rehoboam. Joab is dealt with, and so he doesn't become a problem. But here, as Rehoboam sets up his kingdom, Jeroboam has become a problem. He is up in the north, and Rehoboam is trying to figure out, what do I do now? And somehow, in Rehoboam's mind, somehow the reasoning went this way. Okay, this is what I'm stuck with. I goofed up. And Rehoboam doesn't admit that. He doesn't admit, you know what? When I said I was bigger and better than my dad Solomon, I really misjudged the situation. He doesn't admit it. What if Rehoboam, and this is the thing, this is the part of this story, as I walk through the Kings, where I constantly ask the question, why didn't you just fix it? Why didn't you just say, I'm really sorry. I really goofed up. What if Rehoboam had gone to the northern 10 tribes and said, guys, you were right and I was wrong? What if he'd just been humble? But he didn't. He didn't just tell the truth. And so what we have is the consolidation of Israel and Judah into two different armed camps. You know, one of my big complaints about television through the years is the situation comedy, right? Or sitcoms, right? Sitcoms drive me crazy. You know, we grew up watching them, and then, you know, and they progressed through the years. But what always bothered me about sitcoms, especially the ones that were geared towards children, is that so much of the force of the story of a sitcom is misunderstanding. I always get about halfway through it and I go, you know, if people would just clearly communicate, the story would just disappear in a puff of smoke. It's so much of the drama, so much of the storyline is pushed by somebody misunderstood what somebody said, or somebody didn't just tell somebody what was going on. If you did that, then the show wouldn't exist, which I guess would undermine the whole purpose of television. But it does, it just strikes me. What if Rehoboam had just taken a moment and said, I messed up. Dad's is a good lesson for you. You're the leader in your home. What if you just at points sat your family down and said, hey, by the way, what happened yesterday was my fault. I just goofed up. You'd find two things happen. First of all, your family's very forgiving. The second thing you would find is that they would get over it very quickly. And you could all move on together. And the only thing bad that would happen is you have always, invariably, one snarky person in the family who would remind you about it for the rest of your life. But that, too, serves a purpose, doesn't it? Right? Keeps us humble as we remember the moment where we goofed up. But there's Rehoboam, who does not have the force of will or character to just say, I messed up and I'm sorry. And so what that does is it puts him on a track, and it is invariably where this goes, is that as Rehoboam leads his people, as he has made this mistake that he does not acknowledge and will not rectify, he and all Israel with him forsakes the Lord. Christian, understand, we talk about this a lot, that beginning well is no guarantee of finishing well. That's because life is not lived in a trend line. It's lived in a series of decisions. It's lived in a series of moments. And those moments, those decisions, those points where you have to decide one way or another can affect everything. And so Rehoboam is sitting there, and he's financially secure, and he's made a mistake, but the mistake is not unfixable. And there's potential, and there's possibility of restoration and fruitfulness and a direction that could, in essence, rescue his people. But he doesn't do that, and that decision seems to doom the nation. And remember, this affected real people's lives. You know, let's say you're a godly person. You're a person who's seeking the Lord, but you're just a normal person. You know, let's say you make shoes for a living, or you're a weaver, or you're a potter, or you're some sort of smelter. You work in the trades, and you and your family are just trying to keep your head down and serve the Lord and seek Yahweh, the God of your people. And that's easy, and it's possible, and it makes sense during the reign of Solomon. And then all of a sudden, within just a handful of years, within 5 years of Solomon's death and Rehoboam's ascension, suddenly the whole nation has walked sideways. And everything that made sense to you, that made sense in your culture, that seemed right and good, every bit of it gets upturned. And suddenly the nation's headed in a direction that no longer seeks the Lord, that no longer honors worship, and you can see the difference. That when you go to the temple, things are not as taken care of as they used to be. That the excitement of worship is not what it ought to be. That the time where people gather is smaller. And you begin to wonder, what's going on in my nation? What's happening? Because remember, between this period and the period of King Josiah is just a couple of hundred years. And during the reign of Josiah, when Josiah came to the throne, they could not find one copy of the law. They discovered the book of Deuteronomy in a dirty corner of a forgotten room in the temple. It had not been read for years. That in the time of Josiah, there were pagan temple prostitutes living in an addition that had been added on to the temple. Just a couple hundred years. Many of you kind of live that way today. You know, you remember when religion was upheld, that it may not have been Christian, but religion in general was upheld in the culture. And now, it seems like if you hold a religious idea, there is a certain amount of suspicion cast upon you, and you wonder, what happened in my country? What's happened in my nation? Well, this has happened before. It'll happen again. That within 5 years of Solomon's death, the entire country had stepped sideways. Well, that's because during Solomon's reign, the tolerance towards false religion had come in, that Solomon's wives served other gods and drew him away to the service of other gods. And so those things which had been in the dark and had been on the side suddenly came into focus and took center stage, that suddenly when Rehoboam was established, they'd gotten strong and established a new normal in the culture. He and all Israel forsook the law of the Lord. And it came about in Rehoboam's fifth year, because they had been unfaithful to the Lord, that Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. He came up with 1,200 chariots and 60,000 horsemen, and all the people who came with him from Egypt were without number. The Lubim, the Sukkim, the Ethiopians, he captured the fortified cities of Judah and came up as far as Jerusalem. Now, what's interesting is we actually have the record of Shishak's conquering of the land. And this has been held up as a real problem, but it's not a problem. It's one of those things where it cracks me up that scholars are so intent that the Bible's wrong that they ignore what the Bible says, right? And so when they look at Shishak's record, which is in Karnak, of his conquering, Jerusalem is not on the list. All of the lands, all of the cities of Judah are, but Jerusalem's not on the list. And so they say, see, the Bible's wrong. Well, actually, the Bible isn't wrong. Notice what it said. He captured the fortified cities of Judah and came up as far as Jerusalem. Many people wonder, well, why did Shishak come? Well, actually, Shishak gives us a record of why. Shishak was starting a dynasty. He wanted to establish his kingdom, and he needed money. He wanted money. So where does he get money? Well, Solomon's dead. And Solomon was sitting on a pile of money. And the total motivation makes perfect sense. The reason he came up into Judah was because he wanted money. Also, his buddy Jeroboam, who had lived under his care for years, is now king in the north. And so if Shishak conquers the south or he impoverishes the south, it helps his buddy to the north and consolidates his forces. That's why. And so Shishak came up to the north just for the cash. And notice, he doesn't waste time taking Jerusalem. He just conquers everything up to Jerusalem and then cuts a deal. The whole reason he was there was for money. He wasn't looking for more land. He had enough property to take care of himself. What he needed was money. Money. Cash. And so he comes up, he captures the fortified cities of Judah, comes up as far as Jerusalem, and then Shemaiah the prophet came to Rehoboam and the princes of Judah who had gathered at Jerusalem because of Shishak and said to them, "Thus saith the Lord, you have forsaken me, so I also have forsaken you to Shishak." So the princes of Israel and the king humbled themselves and said, "The Lord is righteous." When the Lord saw that they humbled themselves, the word of the Lord came to Shemaiah, saying, "They have humbled themselves, so I will not destroy them, but I will grant them some measure of deliverance, and my wrath shall not be poured out on Jerusalem by means of Shishak. But they will become his slaves, so that they may learn the difference between my service and the service of the kingdoms of other countries." That isn't asking much, is it? Sometimes the Lord deals with us on the basis of just what's real. Sometimes he deals with us on the basis of his ideal. Now, I want you to understand something. That because you are the adopted child of God, you have been saved by his grace and been brought into his kingdom, God is never going to deal with you just on what's real. He's going to deal with you on what's ideal. That means God will break the world apart to get to your heart. And if there is something that you are keeping from his grasp, if there's something that you're withholding from him, if there's some area of your life where you're not in service to him, God's going to break your life apart to get to you. That's just the way it is. It seems to be the overwhelming promise of the New Testament, that if you're God's creature, he's called you as his child, he will not leave you alone. And it seems to be that if we take the hints of the New Testament, God will even kill you to keep you from wandering too far. And then you can sleep well at night knowing that that's the case. However, Rehoboam, in the terms of an Old Testament saint, we don't see Old Testament sainthood. What we see here is a guy who's really not in it. He's not, his heart is not in the Lord. It's not with the Lord. He's not in service to God. Rehoboam is a guy who is just living in a pragmatic world, but he happens to be the king of Israel who God has called by his own name. I've oftentimes wondered about this in Great Britain. In Great Britain, the sovereign of Great Britain is the head of the Anglican Church. Well, what if the king or queen is not a believer? Well, they're still the head of the Anglican Church. That seems weird to us, doesn't it? Right? The idea that the head of your church, you know, here you are as a bishop in the church, you're a believer, you know God, and you're dealing with somebody who's the head of the church who you know isn't saved. It seems like that would be an untenable, unacceptable situation, at least to me. People in Great Britain have somehow gotten their head around it. But that's the case in Israel, is that at points, the king is the king of Israel, his direct servant of God. But Rehoboam doesn't know God, doesn't show any sign of knowing God. And yet here you are as an Israelite, as a Jewish person, trying to live unto the Lord, having to recognize and acknowledge that the king who God has placed over you doesn't know him. And God is just dealing with Rehoboam in the reality of the situation. The reality of the situation is Israel has walked away from the Lord. These guys don't know God, don't care to know God, have no interest in God. And so God abandons them to judgment, and when they show a modicum of humility, a modicum of repentance, God restores to them a certain measure of success. Notice, the prophet comes in and says, you failed in walking with God, and so God's abandoned you to judgment. You're under Shishak. And so these guys respond, and you can almost, you almost feel the reticence to do so. The Lord is righteous. You're right. You're right. God's righteous. Imagine if that were David. If the prophet came to David and said, David, you failed. What does David do? He falls down on his knees and he cries. Probably writes a psalm about how big a dirtbag he is. Man, I am terrible. I have walked away from the Lord. This is unacceptable for me. But Rehoboam, he looks at the situation militarily, financially, pragmatically, and says, you're right. You're right. God's righteous. And so God says, okay, because you've acknowledged that, I'm not going to abandon you completely. But you're going to be his slave so that you can know that if you had walked with me, it would be much better. And instead, you're going to know the difference. You're going to know the difference between service to me and service to these foreign conquerors. You're going to know the difference. I'm going to let you see it. Verse 9. So Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, took the treasures of the house of the Lord, the treasures of the king's palace. He took everything. Sounds like when the Grinch stole Christmas, doesn't it? He took everything. Even the roast beast. I'm sorry. For those of you who watch children's television, you get a real kick out of that. For those of you who don't, it means it's meaningless. Pastor's lost his mind. He took everything. He took the golden shields which Solomon had made. Then King Rehoboam made shields of bronze in their place and committed them to the care of the commander of the guard who guarded the door of the king's house. Now, this is a point. He took everything. Well, how much did he take? Well, we don't know. We don't know how much Solomon had. But we do know this. Shishak died just a handful of years after this event. Shishak came up. He took the treasures of the house of Israel. He went down, reconsolidated his forces. He had a son. His son, in the first few years of his reign, decorated the temples to the false gods in Egypt with almost 400 tons of gold. 400 tons. I think the exact figure was 373 tons of gold. Where did he get the money? Solomon and Rehoboam. And he took everything. And so there's Rehoboam. He has made himself strong in Jerusalem. All right, yeah. I'll just pretend that the northern 10 tribes, you know, two-thirds of the population wandered away. Let's ignore that. You know what? We're better off for being smaller. We're better off for being smaller now. Yeah, that's the ticket. Benjamin and Judah, we're better than all of those guys put together. And we have the money. No, you don't. Because Shishak came up and he took it all. And so what does Rehoboam do now? Does he fall on his face and say, God, I am a fool? No. No, he says, we're out of gold. So here's what we'll do. We'll make some bronze shields, bronze. Don't you always feel bad for the people at the Olympics who wins bronze medals? You know, probably not as bad for them as the fourth guy who gets a whole lot of nothing. Right? But the gold medal, gold, I can pawn that, right? Silver, same. Bronze, who wants that? We're going to make some bronze shields, and we're going to pretend nothing happened. Now, Rehoboam makes fakes to look like the real thing. He pretends. Notice, all the way through, he just pretends nothing significant has happened. But everybody knows the world's changed. When you don't walk with God, you're stuck with consequences. And with those consequences, you do one of two things. Either you learn from them and turn, or you pretend nothing has happened. Christian, have you ever been there? When you're dealing with the consequences of your sin, you're dealing with consequences of a life lived outside of the Lord, and you don't want to acknowledge what's happened, so you just pretend nothing's happened. That's Rehoboam. No real walk with God. No real spiritual bone in his body. And so he just pretends nothing happens. It's the great pretend. And Christian, I want you to understand that. That's what people are left with. And we live in a culture today which I think is pretending on every level. They're living with consequences of tremendously bad financial decisions, tremendously bad lifestyle decisions, tremendously destructive lifestyle choices, and yet they're pretending that nothing has happened. And actually, what has become commonplace is that when someone stands up in the culture and says, look at the consequences of this, they are shouted down and told to shut up. That's where we are. And actually, that's the future of Israel. What we're going to see in the Kings is so much of if sin were just acknowledged and people learn to walk with God and learn to do that for any length of time, there would be a restoration of God's work. Instead, what we see are momentary consequences with momentary repentance, with a return to the same old junk over and over again. Well, guess where we are? And the question that really stands before you today is, what are you going to make of your future? Because remember, beginning well is no guarantee that you get to coast for the rest of your life. It's no guarantee that you're going to finish well. And many of you have been absolutely disappointed to watch people in your life who seem to walk with God, seem to know God, and as they've aged, as they've matured, they've gone backwards in their faith and in their faithfulness. In their growth of their character and the transformation of their being, they've stepped backwards, and you've watched people who seem to know God and trust Him become fearful and doubtful and embarrassing. And that's the state of Israel. That these people who in a flash of a pan, in a moment of absolute wonder, captured 80 years of what it looked like to walk with God, and then fell so far backwards that they could hardly be recognized as the nation of Israel at all. So that by the time that Jesus is born, those people living long since the good old days are still hearkening back to the days of David, still longing for a king like him. Because everything between then and now is an utter embarrassment and a shame. That David's kingdom, followed by Solomon, becomes a model of what Jesus would do in a broader, bigger way. Nobody looks back on Ahijah and says, boy, those were the days. Nobody looks on those days and says, man, look at what God did. These guys consistently just failed. Having begun so well, they finished so poorly. Christian, what are you going to do? It's never too late to do the right thing. Never too late to capture your future. Your past is your past. Never too late to capture your future, to face the reality, to acknowledge failure, to adjudicate it properly, and then to turn around and walk in a different direction, to recapture something which God promised at the cross and delivered early in your Christian life and which you have let fade. It's never too late. Because the future of Israel from here on is one of deep sadness. Because Rehoboam, from this point on, he strengthens himself again and pretends nothing happens. He fronts as if Solomon never failed, as if the kingdom under him was no better. And you can sit around and pretend nothing's happened, or you can face it head on and change what the future might bring. Let's go to prayer. Father, we do just ask that you would make us your people. And as we head back into the Kings, these practical lessons for practical Christians so that we may live practical Christian lives, help sharpen us, make us what you want us to be. Help us to learn from the past that we might not fail in our future and fail those around us who depend on us. And it's in your name we pray. Amen.